Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 131. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two very, very different movies, one from 1940 and one from 1973. The 1941 is John Ford's Grapes of Wrath, and the one from 1973 is François Truffaut's La Nuit Americaine, also known as Day for Night. So we've got going from Henry Fonda on his Okie Odyssey through to Jacqueline Bisset's Mercy Fuck. So sit back and enjoy yourself. I'll get the contact details out of the way, and then we'll get on with the show.
They say the world doesn't have heroes anymore? Well, damn them, Max. You and me, we're going to give them back their heroes. Hi there, this is Fifi from Mad Max, and you're listening to Paleo Cinema.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a two-weekly podcast of classic movie appreciation. Any movie is up for grabs, except it has to be more than 20 years old at the time of recording. Now, feedback is very, very important to us. So, we have a brand new voicemail number. Please write it down. 206-202-4520. You can also send emails to cultguru@gmail.com. That is cultguru@gmail.com. Or if you're on Facebook, you can go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and check it out. You can also leave feedback at the website for the podcast, which is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Now, you will hear some adult concepts and occasional coarse language on this podcast, so if you're offended by that, skip over that bit and enjoy the rest. Alternately, you can not listen to the podcast at all. It's entirely up to you. Okay, how is everybody going? Things here are turning autumnal, which means that it's getting colder, and it's not my favourite time of year when things start getting colder, but I'm manfully managing to survive it with very, very little whinging apart from on this bit. How is everyone? We're doing fine here. Congratulations to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema for the successful Indiegogo campaign to get a DVD release for Final Score. They reached their goal, and the DVD with the Gentleman's Guide commentary is going to be produced. I'm in there for a copy of it myself, and I contributed, and I think it's a worthy cause, and that the guys are definitely on new frontier for podcasting, and particularly for their own kind of podcasting, which is kind of cool. And I look forward to getting my copy of the DVD once it is pressed, released, and mailed to me. So, on you guys, you did well. Sal and I are planning a little bit of a holiday too. I should mention that in April we're going to go up to Sydney to visit family, and then up into the Blue Mountains to chill out. Basically, we're going to have 2 weeks off in April, just after Easter. So I'm going to try to get ahead with the podcast so I can just release them while I'm away and not deprive my listening public of the not-so-dulcet tones of my own voice. But that's I'll get into that a little bit closer to the time. So, what have I been watching? I did watch one of the big and controversial movies of 2014, Nymphomaniac, the Lars von Trier film. I've seen Volume 1 and Volume 2. Even though technically Volume 2 hasn't been released yet, I have seen it. It's about a woman called Jo, played by Stacey Martin and Charlotte Gainsbourg at various times of her life, who is a classic nymphomaniac and basically acts like a sexually adventurous man would. The name, of course, has a certain sexual ambiguity to it. There's a lot of controversy about this, about how explicit it is, and whether it's a good film or a bad film and all that kind of thing. It's got Stellan Skarsgård in it, so it's definitely got a plus there. And it is very transgressive, and Jo as a character says things that I find a bit morally repugnant at times, but in general, I think it's a good film. It is funny in places as well. It is I think one of Von Trier's best, and I think that we need directors and movie makers in general who push boundaries. You can't just keep doing the same stuff again. You've got to go into the dark places. You've got to go into the unpleasant places to make films sometimes, and Von Trier does that very well. And it's a very accomplished film. The acting is superb. If you're not into the sexually explicit material and you don't like to be challenged morally by cinema, you probably want to avoid it. But if you are interested in transgressive cinema and Von Trier in specific, I recommend that you see it. It's worth seeing, and it is nice to see a movie where women have pubic hair. But, having said that, I agree, it's not for everybody. Let me see what else I've been watching. I haven't been watching a massive amount of cinema, but I have been watching a little bit. I did see The Last Stand, the Arnold Schwarzenegger action pick with Johnny Knoxville, amongst other people in it. And, yeah, I think it works really well. I like the... it's got a little bit of Bad Day of Black Rock about it. It's got a little bit of High Noon about it. It's a lot of fun and not to be taken at all seriously. And I think Schwarzenegger, particularly with this one and the movie he did with Stallone very recently, I forget the name of it, but what the fuck. I think there's kind of a renaissance for these guys in doing action films. It makes you wince a little bit because the guys have got to be getting a bit brittle these days. And, it's a bit of a worry if they start bashing themselves around a bit too much. But you can do a lot with human growth hormone, so maybe they'll be okay. But that's definitely a recommended one. It sets the action very well. There's not too much shaky cam and fast cuts and things like that, which is good, and it's a good, honest effort. Let me have a look here. So I'm saving the genre films I talk about till I do Martian Drive-In. I did rewatch Shaft, the original 1971 Richard Roundtree Shaft, and it still stands up well. I picked up a cheap Blu-ray of it and put that in there and really grooved on the Isaac Hayes soundtrack and the sleaziness of Times Square in the 1970s and the grooviness of it all. And, it does hold up well as an action film. And there have been a few discussions around Facebook, particularly Stephen Barnes, a very fine speculative fiction writer, talking about the emasculation of black males in cinema, how in mainstream movies black guys never get laid and are kind of emasculated for that reason. White guys get laid a lot more in movies than black guys, in other words. And Shaft was name checked in there, so I thought I'd go back to it. And yeah, I can see their point there. But I think in general, in mainstream cinema, pretty much everybody is emasculated. Nobody has a healthy and open sexuality these days, leaving aside Lars von Trier, who isn't very mainstream, of course. But I think there is that argument that there is a kind of desexualization in cinema as we get an increase in violence. And that's something that should be addressed. I think a good, healthy sexuality is important. And in cinema particularly, we shouldn't be judgmental of people who freely make love with other people. And there is a lot of bullshit that goes on with that in cinema. And I think it's a sop so that they get a few sales among fundamentalist Christians. And I really think it's an emasculation of cinema in general, and particularly men of color. Leaving aside things like 12 Years a Slave and all that kind of stuff. In general, there's not a lot there. But I saw that. Let me have a look at the other things. I've seen a couple of other things as well. I did see a really bad comedy by Buck Henry from 1980 called First Family, which is about a very kind of an inept president played by Bob Newhart and his wife played by Madeleine Kahn and their daughter played by Gilda Radner. There's a lot of racist shit in this about African countries and things like that. I watched it, but I don't recommend it. It really is a piece of shit. So that's pretty much what I've been watching. I've been watching a lot of television lately. And as people who follow my Twitter stream on Monday nights will tell you. I'm also tweeting on a few political TV shows in Australia and in general stirring the shit with those. So I'm going to take a break, and then when I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two films. I think I'll do La Nuit Americaine, the Day for Night, the François Truffaut film, and then leave Grapes of Wrath for second. So sit back, and I'll be back in a moment.
I used to get awfully moody when dating a fair-skinned cutie, 'cause every red-hot beauty turned out to be bitchy inside, like something had crawled right up her ass and died. But then I met you, my troubles were through. I whispered I'd do and promised I'd stay in love with you. The day I met you, you know that I knew you'd be a great screw. Thank God I met you. My love and put it all over your face and your hair. I never imagined I could walk on air. But then I met you, my troubles were through. I whispered I'd do and promised I'd stay in love with you. The day I met you, know that I knew my world was brand new. Thank God I met you. Thank God I met you. Thank God I met you.
That, of course, was Family Guy cast with But Then I Met You, which I like. So on to La Nuit Americaine. Doing a French film for a podcast, an English language podcast particularly, is a bit difficult. It's hard to get the clips right. You know you're missing some nuance somewhere because you're looking at subtitles for a film in a foreign language, even though I am muddling through my Duolingo to learn a little bit of French. And I'm still at the stage where I pick up phrases, not sentences in context. So it's It's an odd thing because I'm kind of neither fish nor fowl with that. I know a little bit. And I go, ah, I understand that word. But, yeah, it leaves you in a strange headspace, a transitional headspace in watching the movie. I may have mentioned this before too, but I have visited the grave of the director of this film, François Truffaut, in Paris 10 years ago. It's a big slab of black granite, basically, and I thought I'd visit it because I was there, and there were any number of other people in the graveyard, Edith Piaf, Georges Méliès, a whole bunch of different people there, and you just wander around, and suddenly you're standing over the earthly remains of some of the most famous creators of art in the world, all in one big bone orchard. It's quite an amazing and mind-blowing thing to do that sort of stuff. And one of the few places in which you can do it is Paris. You go to a few different cemeteries and you cover an immense amount of culture from Jim Morrison to Nijinsky. It's a mind-blowing thing to do. But anyway, I'll just play the English language trailer for Day for Night, give a bit of a pricing, and then have a chat about it.
She lives in illusion. Emotion is skill.
What are you doing here? Monsieur and I want to be alone tonight. Get out! And this I do not accept.
It's hopeless. She'll never make it.
It's not my fault!
Cut.
No, it's not my fault.
Love, a device. A man may be a girl.
It's an inflatable dummy. It sits on the seat.
Hey, what's going on?
And day can serve for night.
So ashamed of all this. No, don't worry, I'll be all right. Just be patient with me, please. I know it's not very professional of me. Everybody's waiting for me. I've never done this before.
It's not important, Julie. We can wait a bit, really. I'm going to talk to Jean-François, and the shooting schedule can be rearranged.
Hey, wait, we can't do this. Everybody's not here yet. Where's Lillian? Where's Lillian? Yeah,
where is she?
Well, where is she?
Hey, Force, may I speak to you a moment?
Sure.
Lillian's not coming.
I found out something, Julie. I discovered a really hideous fact. You can love someone. You can be crazy in love, and at the same time hate, despise all that she does, her spirit and her mind.
Boss, you're going to stay till you finish the work.
Okay, so Day for Night is a 1973 film directed by François Truffaut. It's a movie, I'll just read the blurb from IMDb because this is pretty concise and it says it all. A committed film director struggles to complete his movie while coping with a myriad of crises, personal and professional, among the cast and crew. So it was written by François Truffaut, Jean-Louis Richard, and I'm just trying to get the third person, Suzanne Schiffman. So basically Truffaut is very much involved in it. And it's filmed in a kind of almost documentary style, which is an interesting choice to make there. So the cast is pretty good too. You have Jacqueline Bisset as Julie, who's an English actress who's just recovering from a nervous breakdown and has come to do a French film. Valentina Cortez as Severine, who is the older woman in the film, an aging actress who has an alcohol problem but is well loved by a lot of people and gives us a kind of little insight into what it is to be an aging actress in an industry that favors youth. You have Jean-Pierre Ormond as Alexandre, who is the older male in the movie, within the movie. And also, he's a closeted gay actor. He does come out a little bit in the movie, but within the movie. And he's very charming and friendly. And even though he does have this secret life, everybody loves him. And he's kind of got a certain wisdom of age about him. I like him a lot as a character. Jean-Pierre Léaud as Alphonse, the kind of young male movie star who is the character I hated in this film. He's an overgrown child, basically. Sense of entitlement. He goes around. He has an unhappy affair with Liliane, played by an actress called Dani, who is leaving him for a stuntman. He doesn't quite know it, and he goes around asking everybody in to do with the film if women are magic. And everybody gives a different answer, which is pretty much no, or yes, men are as well. We're all magic, or none of us are. So he goes around doing that. He's basically thick. And there are a whole bunch of other people. The director of the film, within the film, Ferrand, is played by François Truffaut himself, which is kind of cool and interesting. And he does have this great quote about making a movie, where he says, pretty much, and this is paraphrasing from memory, that making a film is like taking a stagecoach ride. At first you want to enjoy the trip, but eventually get to the stage where you just want to get to your destination. And he does have a lot of problems there. They've got a problem with Severine being drunk and not remembering her lines and not remembering the stage direction. There's an extended scene of that going on there where, amongst other things, they have to do a little bit of a Marlon Brando thing where the dialogue for the scene has to be written up on pieces of paper on the wall so Severine can read them off the wall, kind of like Marlon Brando did in a lot of his later films where he either couldn't or couldn't be bothered remembering the dialogue. And it's not a scene that's played for you dumb bitch. It's not played like, you know, you dumb bitch, you don't know what you're doing. It's more played as a sympathetic thing, and everybody is considerate of her and her inability to do it to a certain extent, even though there was a certain amount of frustration among the crew. They're professional about it to a greater extent than she is as an actress, which makes it kind of interesting too, that the people around the talent, in a sense, are the kind of diehard professionals, and indeed is Alexandra and the character played by Jacqueline Bisset. There's a kind of spectrum, Julie her name is, there's a spectrum of attitudes among the cast and crew of the film within the film, which is kind of interesting, where a lot of them are really professional, and even though particularly Julie is emotionally fragile and has a story arc which has the potential to set her back enormously, it's her professionalism that kind of sees her through, and her work ethic that sees her through some emotional reverses in the film. I'll do a little bit of a spoiler. It's not too much of a spoiler because it is in the trailer. Julie, the character, after Alphonse, the Jean-Pierre Léaud character's girlfriend, leaves him, throws him a mercy fuck, even though she's only recently married to a much older man who was also her doctor when she was ill. And they do seem to be a dedicated couple, but just to get the movie made, to stop Alphonse from leaving and ruining the whole film, Julie throws him a mercy fuck. And then Alphonse, being the selfish, stupid git he is, calls Julie's husband and tells him about it. And that causes some ructions in there as well. Like I said, I don't like the Alphonse character. I think he's an idiot. And he's one of those guys with a sense of entitlement, which is something I fight against in my own life, and which I don't like in other people. Whereas the older male character in... older male actor in the film, Alexandra, doesn't really have that sense of entitlement. What he has is he's very charming, he's very witty, he's very nice to everybody, and he's enjoying what he does. He has a passion for what he does, and his professionalism is really the defining trait of the character, which I kind of like. Yeah, I mean, there is a plot arc with Alexandra, which does impact the rest of the film in a lot of ways without doing any spoilers on it. And he is, in a sense, even though he doesn't have the central place in the film, he's an important character, an important part of the ensemble. And the things that occur in his life really do have an impact on the way the rest of the film plays out, which is kind of cool and kind of nice. I do like movies that are about making movies as well. And the making of the movie within the film, which is called Je vous présente Pamela, may I introduce Pamela, is a lot of fun. You get to see that kind of hidden knowledge stuff, the background things, the fact that the director has to choose everything for the film from amongst a short list that people provide him, even things like a gun to be used in a certain scene. They give him a range of guns and say, which one do you want? And colours of costumes, the colours of wigs, everything's run past the director. And the interesting thing here too is that Ferron, the director played by Francois Truffaut, has a hearing aid in, one of those big old, you know, jacket button sized hearing aids in there. And that's really a kind of an in joke in a sense, because everybody has to ask him questions all through the film as the camera follows him through on set and backstage and off into the back lot of the studio they're filming in Nice. Everybody's constantly asking Ferron questions, and asking questions of a deaf man is the kind of in-joke that they have here. Now, this, in a sense, Truffaut reminds me a little bit of Tarantino, who I spoke about in the last podcast, in the fact that he started out as a film geek rather than a filmmaker. He was originally a film critic in Cahiers de Cinéma, the famous French cinema magazine in the 1950s, before he did his first big feature film, 400 Blows, which also starred Jean-Pierre Léaud. He started out as a film geek. And so he's got that interest in the history of film and the minutiae of film. In fact, there's a dream sequence of Ferron as a child stealing movie stills from a cinema. And there's another scene where, as they're talking about the making of the film within the film, Je vous présente Pamela, he gets a bunch of books that he had delivered, and they're all basically works about famous filmmakers. And you see a little bit of a montage of the covers of the books. There's one about Hitchcock, there's another one about Jean-Luc Godard, and it just shows that movie directors and people making films do also have that aspect of being film geeks as well. If you at all liked or friended anybody in the filmmaking industry on Facebook, for instance, the thing they talk about is the not necessarily the films they're making or the films they have made, but the films they like and the films they were inspired by. There's a lot of stuff on their Facebook profiles and Facebook pages about other people's work, and that's kind of cool too. I really do like that. I like the fact that I can connect with these people because of a shared passion we have for cinema. And that's kind of neat. The other thing is, there's a few different things about this film that make it really interesting. One of the smaller characters, Odile, is played by an actress called Nike Origi, who was also the female lead in Devil Rides Out, the Hammer horror film in 1968. She pops up almost unrecognizable in the film. And there is a cameo by one of the greatest authors of the 20th century in this film, who was a great fan of Truffaut's movies, and when the opportunity arose to visit the set, he asked if he could have a role in the film. And Truffaut said, yeah, we've got this English insurance broker that we need to have, and there's about three lines of dialogue. Do you want to do it? And Graham Greene, yes, the guy who wrote The Third Man and Ministry of Fear and all those other classic works that became films, said yes. So Graham Greene turns up as an English insurance broker in this movie, which is another bit of a squee for both literary and cinema fans there. This isn't the perfect film. I think it's very much a bit of a smarty pants movie in a way, where Truffaut is showing that, showing his love of film, and also his the stuff he has to go through to make a film. And I think it's kind of, in a very subtle and oblique way, kind of autobiographical for him. There's a scene, he had a scene in a previous movie with a kitten drinking milk. So there's a scene in this film where they cut away from the two mismatched lovers in the movie down to a breakfast tray, which is left outside the hotel room. And a kitten is supposed to come along and drink the milk out of the coffee cup on the tray. And they show the immense tassels they have to get a kitten to trot across a path and drink milk out of a tray. They get a cat at first, and then the first kitten doesn't work, so they find a cat who lives at the movie studio, and they use that cat for the job. But it's not actually that cat, because the cat you see them get is bigger but the same color as the one as a kitten who eventually they get the scene with. So there's also there's lots of little bits which could be seen as goofs and mistakes in the film, which are actually little subtle things saying, yeah, they couldn't get that cat to drink the milk either, so they had to get a third cat to do the scene that they needed for the film. So there's lots of little discontinuities which could be seen as mistakes by the filmmakers, but are actually deliberate things by Truffaut, which kind of makes it a little bit meta there. And I do like that stuff. Let me see. Yeah, I'm looking at the goofs at IMDb, and they mentioned that one I just mentioned about the different cats, which I hadn't looked at until now. And there's a couple of bits where you see the film crew reflected in the door of a bus, for instance, and those little bits and pieces of mistakes in the film are deliberately left in there. It's one of those things that somebody like Truffaut would pick up on and refilm. And they do have another bit where there's a car crash going off a cliff, and they're filming the dailies of it, and you see the two fingers shaped like scissors of Truffaut going across in shadow in front of the dailies and just going snip, where they're going to cut the stunt of driving the car off the cliff, and where they're going to make it look like it's actually Jacqueline Bisset's character driving towards a cliff in the car. So it's really nice from that point of view of the background stuff from 1970s filmmaking. Of course, I'm sure there are a lot of differences now with the technological changes on how things are done, but Day for Night does take you behind the scenes a little bit from the viewpoint of a filmmaker rather than from the viewpoint of an outsider coming in, the way a lot of documentaries about films are made. There's also another actor that only appears and has some scenes once, an actress called Zenaide Rossi, who plays the wife of one of the crew who distrusts immensely filmmaking people. And she basically sits outside the studio every day to make sure her husband isn't kind of, you know, dragged away by one of these wretched, sexually active women in the filmmaking process. And she gets to rant at Ferron, the director, coming in and ranting at him about how immoral filmmakers are and things like that. And she's a monstrous fury who lets her own personal fears about her relationship with her husband basically fuck up his job, which is kind of an interesting thing there. And it could well be related to something that Truffaut has previously experienced. But having somebody who comes in into her husband's workplace and rails against the people who he works with is, apart from being very uncool, something that's monstrously and horribly understandable. Fear makes people do stupid things, and that's one of the other themes in this film as well. that when people are scared, they do dumb shit. And I kind of like that as a theme in a film. That even though, and the other, one of the other things too is, the question gets asked in explicitly and implicitly in the film. Is making a film more important than other aspects of the filmmakers' lives? Is it the completion of a movie more important than a long-term relationship? Is it more important than the sanity of a person? Is it the most important thing, or should it be put into a wider context of somebody's life? And that you don't get any definitive answers. Each character who kind of addresses the question has a different answer for it and a different way of managing that dichotomy between the work and the personal. And that's a question that all of us have to deal with in some ways. How do you balance your work life with your personal life? And this film just puts it into the context of a movie making, which is kind of cool. It's not my favorite Truffaut film. I still think The Bride Wore Black is my favorite Truffaut film, and I'm going to have to talk about that in a future podcast. But it's a good, honest effort, and I wanted to do a movie about making movies, which is kind of a fun thing for me. My favorite film, of course, being The Bad and the Beautiful, which is a movie about making movies, and this one is as well. Really a lot of fun, and the music is by one of the great French film composers, Georges Delerue, and there's a little bit in the film where Delerue talks on the phone. He's on the other end of a phone line with Ferrand, the film director, and plays a little bit of the music from the film to him over the phone. So they've even got a kind of oblique cameo from the film's composer in this movie. Now, the film won a BAFTA award for Best Film in 1974 and the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. And Valentina Cortes was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress and Truffaut for the Academy Award in Directing, but they didn't get it. And Valentina Cortes's role as Severine is worthy of that nomination. It really is a nice portrayal of a vulnerable, aging actress who makes her own problems worse because of her habits. And, I like it. The more I think about it, the more I like it. And that's always a sign of a good film. But still, The Bride Wore Black I prefer more. And I'm really going to have to up that further up the list of the films to talk about on the podcast, because I really think that that's one of the funniest and blackest of Truffaut's movies. So that's about it for Dave and I. You really should see it. It's a lot of fun. And I know you're all film buffs, and it's that kind of movie that the film buffs will get the most out of rather than just casual film viewers. I did watch a little bit of it with the English language dubbing, but definitely go with, of course, the subtitle version with the original French dialogue. It does play a lot better that way. So I'm going to take another break now. And when we get back, we're going to talk about a 1940 film, Grapes of Wrath, one of the best films ever made by a lot of people's criteria, and a movie which has certain resonances for me and what's going on in my country in 2014.
One night Farmer Brown was taking the air, locked up the barnyard with the greatest of care. Down in the hen house something stirred when he shouted, "Who's there?" This is what he heard: "There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble with your chin. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. You're stomping around and shaking the ground. You're kicking up an awful dust. We chickens trying to sleep and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble. It's a sin. Tomorrow is a busy day. We got things to do. We got eggs to lay. We got ground to dig and worms to scratch. It takes a lot of setting, getting chicks to hatch. Oh, there ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So quiet yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. Kindly point that gun the other way and hobble, hobble, hobble off and hit the hay. We got things to do, we got eggs to lay, we got ground to dig and worms to scratch. It takes a lot of setting, getting chicks to hatch. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So quiet yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. And kindly point that gun the other way and hobble, hobble, hobble off and hit the hay. Hey, hey, boss man, what do you say? It's easy pickings. There ain't nobody here but us chickens.
That was Louis Jordan with Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens. And now we're getting into one of the great movies of the 1940s. Grapes of Wrath, directed by John Ford, starring Henry Fonda and Jane Darwell. And if you haven't read the original novel by John Steinbeck, I recommend that you do so. It's a fantastic piece of fiction. It's dark, it's horrible, and yet it's hopeful. And indeed, the movie is as well. And it was filmed in black and white. It's in Academy ratio, so there's no widescreen on it. But it tells the story of essentially refugees and the refugee experience. Now, I'll get a bit of a blurb in case for some reason you haven't heard what it's about. I'm going for succinct blurbs and succinct synopses this time around. And the IMDb one simply says, a poor Midwest family is forced off their land. They travel to California, suffering the misfortunes of the homeless in the Great Depression. And that's pretty much it. The Jode family, the son Tom has been in jail for murdering a man. There's an argument that it was self-defense, but one way or the other, he got out of jail a seven-year stretch in 4 years because of good behavior and travels back to the family farm and finds it deserted. And there's dust and everything's deserted. But he does meet somebody while he's there. A fantastic little cameo by an actor called John Quaylan, playing a guy called Muley, who's travelling from house to house, just hiding them, homeless and broken and unable to move past the place where he grew up and the place where his family grew up. And Muley tells him that his family had been dispossessed of the land because they were sharecroppers, and the economics of their kind of subsistence farming has changed with the advent of tractors and Caterpillar tractors and other heavy machinery. So they've been dispossessed of the land and they're assembling to go to California. They're going to travel in a rickety old truck they've got all the way to California because they found a handbill which says that they need fruit pickers out there. So they're going out there to be fruit pickers, and in the middle of the Depression, in the middle of the dust bowl of the Great Depression, the family, a whole bunch of them on a truck, go from Oklahoma to California in search of a better life. It's essentially economic refugees in a lot of ways, traveling across America at a time when very few people had any money to speak of, and where there were few protections. There wasn't a social safety net for people to travel there. And it tells the story of the Jode family doing so. Now, Steinbeck wrote the novel having researched things thoroughly. And the movie studio picked up the novel and had the movie out within a year of the novel being out. Now, that's a hell of a fast turnaround time. They got John Ford to direct it, and Nunnally Johnson did the script. And they actually sent some researchers out to find out what the camps were like in California for Okie workers traveling, who travel from the Midwest Dust Bowl across to California, and to see whether Steinbeck's novel and the script that had been written by Nunnally Johnson were exaggerating about the camp life in the camps that spontaneously formed, full of migrant workers looking for work, starving, literally starving, and without hope. And so the researchers came back and told them that Steinbeck had underplayed the privation and hardship of these people. So they knew they were on the right track there. They couldn't really show things as they really were. The studio censorship, the Hays office, wouldn't let them tell it accurately. But what they did manage to get through in the screenplay and into the movie is hard enough. It's an immensely powerful and emotionally powerful movie about survival, and also about cruelty and about the innate cruelty of the capitalist economic system, which is really a bit surprising, because even though John Ford said he was a Democrat, he was very conservative about a lot of things. He was a very right-wing kind of guy. He had been known to throw crew members off a production if they swore in front of a woman. He was a very conservative guy. His wife every day would give him 12 handkerchiefs to take to work with him. And he'd spend the whole day chewing on the edge of these handkerchiefs while he was making the movies. And every night his wife would get back 12 handkerchiefs that were chewed to buggery in the corners. He never drank during the making of a film, but when the movie was over, he would wrap a bedsheet around himself, naked in his office in a bedsheet, drink himself stupid, and then regret it and sober up and get straight and get right before the next film came out. He wouldn't have been an easy man to live with. And, of course, he had those contradictions in his character. In a lot of ways, he was a fucking nut. But he made some of the best cinema of the middle 20th century coming out of America. And we're all grateful for that. I'll just play the trailer for Grapes of Wrath just to give you a bit of an idea about the impact it had at the time. Now, this is very much a 1940s trailer, so bear with it.
Sweeping across the country comes one of the great literary achievements of our time. A human, revealing, soul-stirring story that instantly becomes the most discussed novel of modern literature. The Grapes of Wrath.
The Grapes of Wrath, please.
I hope to put you on the waiting list. We've never had such a demand for a book. Do you have a copy of Grapes of Wrath?
Sorry, we're all sold out.
Yes, The Grapes of Wrath. Well, send me as many copies as you can. I can't supply the demand.
The Grapes of Wrath.
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 As sales skyrocket, The Grapes of Wrath becomes the book of the nation. Everyone, everywhere, joins in the discussion of its vital problems. Due to this unprecedented popularity, producers vie for the motion picture rights. And finally, 20th Century Fox announces the purchase of the book and plans for its immediate production. A storm of discussion arouses the nation. Speculation and rumor are rife to the effect that no producer will venture to film this great dramatic masterpiece of human hearts. Daryl F. Zanuck, production head of 20th Century Fox Studios, emphatically announces that The Grapes of Wrath will be made. All of the resources of this vast studio are marshaled for the production. John Ford, Academy Award winner, is given the directorial assignment. The cast is carefully chosen to make John Steinbeck's unforgettable characters come to life. Tom Joad is played by Henry Fonda. Maud Joad is played by Jane Darwell. Casey is played by John Carradine. Grandpa is played by Charlie Grapewin. Rosa Sharon is played by Doris Bowden. Paul Joad is played by Russell Simpson. Al is played by O.Z. Whitehead. Muley is played by John Quaylen. Connie is played by Eddie Quillen. And now, at last, The Grapes of Wrath is ready for the screen as the motion picture captures all the drama, suspense, action, tears and laughter of the story that stirred a nation.
John Ford won an Academy Award for Best Director for this film, and rightly so. It's an amazing piece of work. The cast is exceptional. John Carradine's in it, playing a friend of Tom Jones, who goes along for the trip to California with him. He's a guy called Casey, who was an itinerant preacher until he kind of decided that he liked girls too much and that affected his preaching. And so he became a bit of a bum wandering around. And eventually Casey becomes very important in Tom Jode's political awakening. The Jode family has very, very little money, and they're traveling in a very unreliable truck across deserts, across mountains, across all sorts of terrain, and they've got an incredibly limited budget to get 12 people across halfway across the country. And part of the movie is that fantastic trip across there, and they turn a trip on Route 66 into an odyssey. There are times when the car breaks down. There are family deaths along the way. They lose some people who simply run away. And there's a great scene in a diner with the waitress, the guy behind the counter, and a couple of truck drivers, which is a balancing thing. That there are two kinds of people that the Jodes meet in this film. The first kind are selfish and cruel and judgmental and prejudiced and basically not forces for good. And then there are other people who don't have to be, who have absolutely no reason to be, but who perform small acts of kindness to the Jodes to help them along, because the Jodes are decent people. They've lived on farms for generations. They've been part of a community, and they've been ripped loose of that community. And they have no choice but to move. Their land's not there anymore. The homes they've had for generations are not there anymore. The one thing they know how to do is not there anymore. But they're hard workers. And even as they travel to California, the family breaks up. And part of the sad part at the ending of the film is that realization by Marjo, played by Jane Darwell, who is fantastic in this film, that the family isn't staying together the way it was, that extended family with roots in one place and one piece of land and one farm is not going to be that way anymore. And her realization of this and her husband's realization that he is no longer the head of the family, his position was lost with the land, and the person keeping the family together is Marjo, with the help of Tom and some of the other family members, but essentially his position in the family as a patriarch has been usurped by circumstance, and he's become a broken man because of it. So the survivors of the Jode family do reach California and reach a camp, which is basically a prison camp in a sense. The housing in the camp is very rudimentary. There's no inside toilets in it. They get paid a pittance for their work over the day. They can only buy things in the shop that the people running the camp own, and they can barely get enough to eat and keep everybody alive while working all day in that place. So the family eventually escapes from there and finds a much better camp run by the Department of Agriculture, with inside toilets and a social life and a position. It's a transient camp still, but it's a much better place for them to be. And the fact that they find just the little courtesies that are extended to them while they're in this camp, a surprise, and they're a bit distrustful of it and a bit amazed that it could happen, is heartbreaking as well. But there are little moments of comedy too. The children have their first encounter with an indoor flush toilet, which is a funny little moment on there. And there are some scenes where the local sheriffs and the sheriff's deputies and the local people in power are trying to break up this government-organized camp by saying it's full of agitators and Reds and things like that, and all the things that people in power tend to do in that sort of circumstance. And the way the camp and the people in the camp handle that is beautiful. It's in the book, it's also in the movie, but the way they handle it is smart, perceptive, and they network to do it too. They're not just working in a hierarchical structure. People network with each other to stop what could be the end of the camp from occurring. And I like that. I like people who outsmart other people in movies rather than just using violence as a solution. It's always a much cooler and more acceptable way of resolving things in a movie to think your way through a problem. And they do that very much in something that could have been very, very dangerous for a lot of people. Now, this movie has a lot of resonances for me and the problem Australia has at the moment with government refugee policy. The experience of the Jones is an experience that a lot of people who want to come to this country, Australia, are experiencing, that dispossession, that not knowing who you are and where you stand in the world, the poverty, the fact that you exist at the whim of other people who don't necessarily have your best interests at heart. They're all part of this film, and they're also part of Australia's refugee policy at the moment. All you have to do is look at my Facebook to see that, or read up on it. Maybe look up a place called Manus Island in New Guinea, or Nauru, and you'll see the kind of things that are being done by the Australian government. And unfortunately, it's both sides of politics who created this problem, being done in the name of Australian people, and with which Australian people don't agree. That had an enormous resonance for me because of this film. Because it is a film about refugees and economic refugees, which is really strange, because there's a bit of demonization of refugees here in Australia, where some people in government are saying they're economic refugees, they're not real refugees. And a refugee is a refugee. Economic refugees are trying to build a better life and trying to move to a place where they can build a better life. There are the other kind of refugees who, if they don't move, will die. But I don't see wanting a better life yourself as being a bad thing. There have been problems with boat arrivals in Australia, where people have got into boats in Indonesia that weren't seaworthy, and about 1,200 people have died trying to get to Australia in the last 10 years. And that's a problem I don't have a solution to. But the refugees in Grapes of Wrath are as much refugees as anybody travelling from, say, Iran to Indonesia trying to get to Australia. They each have enormous stories to tell about the difficulty of travel, the poverty, the hopelessness of their travel. And for that reason, I think this movie is one that resonates through time. Unfortunately, in the human life and in human history, there will be refugees. And it's movies like this and works of art that tell these stories that reminds those of us who are fairly comfortable that these people are as human as us, and in some ways they are much braver than us of necessity, and that we need to find ways to treat people who come to us for help in a much more humane way. And one of the stories that the Grapes of Wrath eventually tells is that the people persist, people abide, people survive, and even though they do go through hellish problems, somehow they keep going on. Now, there are two great speeches at the end of this film, one by Ma Jode and one by Tom Jode. Tom kills a man who's just killed Casey, and he eventually gets to the stage where he knows the police are closing in on him. He's got to leave the family and become a fugitive. And there is also a speech right at the end where Marjo basically says they're going to survive. And Jane Darwell's fantastic in this speech. But I'm going to play the one, the more famous one, which is the one that Henry Fonda tells Marjo, played by Jane Darwell, at the end of the film.
Well, maybe it's like Casey says. A fella ain't got a soul of his own, just a little piece of a big soul. The one big soul that belongs to everybody. Then
what, Doc?
Then it don't matter. I'll be all around in the dark. I'll be everywhere. Wherever you can look. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there too.
I don't understand it, Doc.
Me neither, Ma, but just something I've been thinking about.
Yeah, so that's almost all I have for you about The Grapes of Wrath, apart from saying see it. One of the interesting things, I found a little bit of trivia that's interesting. Jane Darwell was an actor for a long time. And if you have a look at Disney's Mary Poppins, the old lady feeding the birds when the Feeding the Birds song is sung is actually Jane Darwell. She was in her 80s at the time and not very well at all. But Disney asked her to do the movie and she came in to be the old lady feeding the birds in that bit of Mary Poppins not long before she died. So that's about it for the podcast and for Grapes of Wrath. It really is a movie to treasure. If you don't have it in your collection, maybe you should. If you have people who whinge about migrants and refugees and things like that, then you should duct tape them to a very sturdy chair and make them watch it with their eyelids pried open. Because I think it has a lot of important things to say that are still relevant to many, many parts of the world. And for my money, it's among John Ford's best films. Yeah, he did some spectacular westerns and other things, but this one rates right up there. It's a fantastic piece of work, and it transcends the country in which it was made in a lot of ways. So that's about it for Paleo Cinema Podcast 131. I'll be back in 2 weeks with something else entirely. No feedback this time, unfortunately, but I would like some, so please drop your MP3s into the email, stick something somewhere where I can grab it, and I'll put it onto the feedback. So take care of yourselves and take care of each other in the next couple of weeks. Next week I have a Martian Drive-In podcast, a very big one with Rob Jan about the DC Cinematic Universe, so please listen to that one. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with a Paleo Cinema. I've already got a couple of movies I think might be good for it, but we'll see how that goes. And in the meantime, take care and have fun.